If you live in a pond, creek, or river, it's important to have a way to stay dry and warm. Feathers are good, but fur can work too if you prepare it the right way. This hour, furry wetland creatures. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be here today, and we'll talk about Iowa wetlands and find out all about furry wetland creatures, including beavers, muskrats, otters, and mink. We'll also talk with Andy Dahl, an arborist at the University of Iowa, about how he has embraced the tree-cutting abilities of beavers who live in the Iowa River to help combat invasive species. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Animals that live in, or at least partly in, the water need to have some very important specializations. And this hour, we're going to talk about some of the most interesting semi-aquatic creatures, the hairy ones. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here. It's a nice warm day, and summer, I think, is officially here.
I think it's really happening. And, of course, Iowa is not famous for its wetlands and lakes like, say, Minnesota is. So let's talk a little bit about wetlands in Iowa, because we used to have a lot more than we do now.
Yeah, well, there are two different kinds of wetlands that I really want to concentrate on. One are what we call riverine wetlands, which means streams and rivers. So these are flowing waters. And then we have what are called the palustrine wetlands, which are the quiet water, what we think of when we think of as a swamp or a wetland. Those are the palustrine ones, the ones that sit out in the middle of a field, of a wet area. And the riverine ones we still have a lot of, although they've certainly been altered. We are a state that is rich in rivers and streams. In fact, all you have to do is travel one state to the west and realize just how many rivers and streams we have. It's really remarkable. And some of those have been altered. We are missing in many cases, some of the oxbows that used to be there. We're missing the meanders because many of those rivers in the early part of the last century, in the early 1900s, got channelized, straightened out. They've been altered significantly. But the ones that have really been altered are the palustrine wetlands, particularly in the sort of the north central third of the state, about 35 counties in the upper third. The last glacier left behind thousands and thousands and thousands of these palustrine wetlands, these shallow water wet spots in the middle of fields. And they range from temporary palustrine wetlands, those were by the 1st of July, they would be all dried up, to ones that were more permanent. Now, we're not talking lakes here, but we're talking ponding of water on the land, and those were primarily the palustrine wetlands that were left by the last glacier. Well, when our European ancestors came in here, they began to say, well, gee, these are kind of in the way. they're making farming, especially in the upper, in those 34 counties. They existed in other counties, but they were especially in those 34 were, I think of them as a gift, but certainly early settlers didn't, because it kept the land and unable to be farmed, putting roads across, building towns was very difficult, et cetera, et cetera. So they began to drain them, and drain them they did. So between, about 1845, 1850, right around there, in other words, after Iowa became an official state, between there and about 1980, we had drained between, depending on whose estimates you take of how many wetlands there were in 1840s and 50s, we drained somewhere between 95 and 98% of them. So it's pretty remarkable. When you have that kind of dramatic change, it's a no-brainer that you also impact the species that used to live there. Now, in trade, what we got was one of the richest agricultural systems in the nation's history, and we also got towns and cities and roads that don't sink into the into the wetlands, that sort of thing. So, you know, we get there's a trade-off, but in terms of a wildlife standpoint, it really does impact those species, including the ones we're going to talk about today.
Well, and you mentioned channelizing streams and rivers, which was something else that was done to maximize the amount of farmland available.
Right.
That also really impacted some of the species that we're going to talk about today, too.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. You know, in paddling the rivers last summer, and we talked about this in an earlier program, I paddled something like 800 and plus miles of Iowa rivers last year in 10 different rivers in the state. And I saw a lot of those have been channelized either in part or in total, and the impact on the critters is considerable. There's no question about it.
Well, let's talk about these creatures because they are such interesting animals. and I want to start with, I mean, we were talking about how humans have transformed the landscape. Let's start with beavers because now, of course, they can't transform the landscape as much as humans can to the degree that
humans
can.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
They really can transform the landscape.
They are engineers. There is no question about it. In fact, when I was first a faculty member here, I had a student who may be listening today. I'm not sure. She was an undergraduate honor student, and she was an civil engineering and environmental studies. And I was her advisor, and she did the engineering calculations on beaver dams and found out that they were incredibly strong, and were engineered just right with that. Particularly on small streams, they would have that they might be built straight across, but when they get a little wider, they have to make them in an arc so that the arc points upstream so that the pressure of the water against them as it fills behind them doesn't bust the dam, as it were. And the older they got, actual stronger they got. So she did all the engineering calculations. It was a wonderful piece of work, I thought. These guys are indeed engineers, and they do alter the landscape. In fact, they've altered it to the point where we realized finally their value, particularly in helping slow down streams and slow down the sediment that comes down the streams. For example, in some of the western states, they have been for the past decade or two now, have been taking beavers out of areas that they're not wanted, transplanting them farther up the headwaters into the mountains, and putting them back in streams up there. So they're building dams on the streams up there, slowing the water down, and therefore slowing the rate of sedimentation into those streams. In the process, they also create wetlands then by building these dams on these moving water streams. They create slow water, slowly moving water wetlands, and those then become habitat for lots and lots of other critters as well. So they're actually using their engineering skills of beaver to naturally transform the landscape. It's pretty amazing.
And that transformation doesn't necessarily have to be a permanent transformation, and there's kind of a cyclical nature to it, right?
Yeah, there sure is. Certainly, we've seen the frequency of floods increasing, and that impacts beaver as well. When you get a 3 or 5 inch rain event in the watershed, we see flash flooding, and that certainly can impact the critters that are living along the river besides humans, and that includes beaver. In many cases, it will blow out their dams, and they frequently build these dams in sort of series of, particularly on Iowa small streams, they'll build a series of three, and then another family group will build another series of three a little bit farther downriver. One of them is usually deeper, bigger than the other two, but they're all sort of made to slow down the water a little bit to enable them to have a place to den up. Now, Iowa beaver are different than beavers that we think of in the far north, where they build these big beaver huts. And The typical children's book or
the Beaver Lodge.
Lodge. Yes, the you see them in children's books and on nature channels and all that sort of thing. But in Iowa, they don't do that. What they do is they burrow into existing mud banks. The entrance is still underwater, just as it is with the lodge. But then it comes up after it gets under the bank. It will tunnel. The tunnel comes up above the water level and burrows back into the bank, where they have an enlarged chamber. It might be underneath the root of a tree, an old stump of a tree, but it may just be in the bank. And if you're a paddler and you're paddling down Iowa rivers, particularly after spring floods or something, sometimes you'll see these holes, these tunnels that are exposed because the bank got eroded away or fell away or something. And you'll see these tunnels that might be a foot and a half in diameter. And you say, my golly, what's that? Well, that's the upper part of the beaver's tunnel going into the chamber.
And is that because of our weather? Because winters don't get quite as cold here?
No, I think it's an opportunistic.
Okay.
They'll do that in, we have mud banks, and farther north, they're rocky shorelines and harder to dig through rock than it is through soil. So I think it's just a matter of taking advantage of what's available here. As I say, they're engineers and they look at what the landscape is and go, this will work what does fine. Now, often the outsides of those along the banks are covered with cut willows or cottonwoods in particular, and so you can kind of tell where they are if you know what you're looking for, because they really, really like willow. Willow and cottonwood both are very digestible, very delicious staple food for them, so they'll cut a lot of those to store for the wintertime.
And let's talk a little bit about the history of beaver in Iowa, because, we talked about how the wetlands changed, and of course that impacted beavers,
right.
But beavers were also a species that was trapped and trapped and trapped because of the desirability of their pelts.
It was the basis of beaver pelts were the basis of European colonization of North America. There's no question that if any single species drove the Europeans here, it was beaver. And in the trade of beaver pelts back to Europe, millions and millions and millions of pelts went across the ocean. It came out of Canada and out of the U.S. Went by way of primarily by way of the St. Lawrence Seaway, across the Great Lakes, and out and across to Europe. And we think of that as the time of the voyageurs and everything. Certainly the French were involved, the British were involved, and Native American tribes. A number of different tribes were involved in that trade. Iowa had lots of beavers prior to them, and they were not totally trapped out, but their populations in Iowa by the middle of the last century were very, very low.
All right, and they have made a tremendous comeback.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that in a moment. We'll talk more about how beavers live. We'll also welcome Andy Dahl into the conversation. He's the facilities management arborist at the University of Iowa and partners with the beavers along the Iowa River. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We will be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and we're talking about furry wetland creatures of Iowa this hour. We started out talking about beavers, and I also want to bring someone else into the conversation. Andy Dahl is the facilities management arborist at the University of Iowa, and if you ever take a walk along the Iowa River in Iowa City, you probably won't see beavers, but you will see their work if you know what you're looking for. It's not hard to find. There are lots and lots of beaver cut trees along the river. And Andy, along with others, has embraced the work of these expert tree cutters. Andy, welcome.
Good morning, Charity. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I know for a lot of people, I get pretty excited when I see beaver cut trees. But for a lot of people, they think, oh no, you know, look, a beaver has cut down that tree. They're going to take all the trees out of this area. They're going to damage this area beyond belief. You have found a way to work with their incredible abilities. Tell me a little bit about your management approach.
Well, that's right. What you want to do is surround yourself with good employees. They make you look better. And, you know, about 3 years ago, we started to see how some activity, you might say. I hesitate to call it damage because it really isn't that bad. People get alarmed when they see this. What they do is they basically coppice the small trees. So these trees will resprout. There's no danger of them dying.
Deforestation.
Yes, right? No. Right. And what they've actually done is helped us open some vistas. So they are almost the perfect employees. They work the night shift. They don't call in sick. And they're so efficient, I'm afraid they might jump over me in the org chart.
Right. And you don't even have to pay them. There's no benefits.
There is a downside, of course. And their tree ID skills aren't the best. It's been my experience that they'll go after everything. Like Jim was saying, they prefer cottonwood and willow. But we like it because they go after a lot of the invasive species that are invading, you know, the river area through town. Siberian elm, white mulberry, tree of heaven. They're more than welcome to those. They'll take some of the more common native species, silver maple, green ash, that sort of thing. And if there's something we want to save, we fence it off. So if we deem a mature native tree valuable, we'll fence that off. If we plant something special, it gets fenced.
So otherwise, how do you fence it to keep the beavers from doing their work?
Well, on large trees, we put chicken wire around up 3 to 4 feet up, and you know, tightly around the trunk. That way they can't pull it off, and they don't like chewing through the wire. On smaller trees, we usually use garden fencing about 4 feet tall and stake it in, because the beavers can get quite large, and they'll bull their way in if the fence is flimsy. So, but other than that, I mean, it's just kind of directing them to the beaver buffet. You know, anything else is fair game.
Right. And as you mentioned, I mean, when they cut a tree, it's not like they're destroying the root system of the tree. So sometimes do you follow up if there are trees that you really want to get rid of after they've taken it down? Do you follow up and make sure that the tree doesn't come back?
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that the mature trees a lot of times won't sprout as vigorously as the young saplings. Really, it sounds like we have a lot of damage on campus. And I was thinking about trees that really were valuable that we had planted, large mature trees. And in 15 years, I've seen maybe 4 or 5. So it's not a huge problem with these valuable trees.
Yeah, I was going to add that I think I've seen them trying oaks. And in some cases, if there's nothing else available, they'll certainly take an oak. But oak for beaver is not as digestible as some of the species, the other low wetland species that you've mentioned, things like silver maple, green ash, elm, cottonwoods, willow. Those are all typical low hardwood species, lowland hardwood species in Iowa, and it's what's usually available along the rivers.
Well, and Jim, we should talk a little bit about their diet, because I know a lot of people, and this is perpetuated in popular media and books and stories about beavers, a lot of people say, well, don't they eat fish? And they don't.
No, they don't, as a matter of fact. They may sample an occasional snail or something, but that's really more typical of their cousin, the muskrat, that will take a few mussels and snails and things like that. Beaver are really pretty exclusively vegetarian, and they'll fell these large, if they take a large tree, they don't necessarily want to put the energy into felling a large tree if they've got a whole bunch of, you know, bite-sized small willows or cottonwoods that are handy. Why bother, you know? So they, but if they have no choice, they'll take down a big tree in order to get to the small mostly finger-sized branches for food. Anything larger than that is really not terribly nutritious. Now, they might use it in dam building if they need to build a dam, and they don't always along Iowa rivers. Are they building any dams at all, Andy?
You know, we had one maybe 10 years ago starting by the Hancher footbridge, but I have seen no evidence of dam. Yeah.
Yeah. If they don't need to build a dam to have sufficient water for swimming or feeling safe, then they don't bother. But that's the only way they will use arm size or leg size, more arm size usually, pieces of log in dam building. Otherwise, it's finger size or smaller, a centimeter or smaller in diameter. Those are the ones that they really like. So they're not going to take big trees as long as they have lots of little things available. But your use of them to get rid of some of the species you don't want, particularly things like I have not seen them take the Siberian elm, so I'm really happy to hear that. That's very
not
exciting.
Not as happy as I. And they also, there's some calorie pear that have escaped. The only one that I can think of that I've never seen damage on, and I wish they would be Tree of Heaven.
Sure, so, exactly.
Hey, Jim, I was wondering, most of the damage we see is, I would say, fall, like Thanksgiving, through, early part of the year. We see very little now. Is that because there's other aquatic plants to eat?
Yeah, there's lots of other stuff available. They'll take everything from the tubers of cattails and particularly things like water lily, if you have any of that. They love those tubers and the flower buds and those sorts of things. So there's just so much more available. Also in the fall of the year, as the days get shorter, it's sort of a trigger to them. Ooh, I've got to put up plenty of food for winter. Gee, I better get busy. And so sometimes I'll take some bigger trees to get at a greater supply of the small branches that they need.
Well, beavers just amaze me on so many levels. But when we're talking about their diet, and then I think about how beavers grow, and they look like they have this enormous amount of fat, especially if they're big, healthy beavers. They get really, really big as they live longer.
25 to 50 pounds.
Right? And they store excess fat in their tails,
right,
and their tails can become enormous. And you just described a diet that, of course, most of us would wither away on.
Right.
They must be incredibly efficient at processing that food.
Very efficient. Very efficient. And they're able to. That's one of the things Andy's probably noticed. So sometimes they'll try a big tree and just kind of abandon it. And I'm sure paddlers and other people who walk along rivers have seen this too. Gee, why did they stop chewing in the tree? Well, it probably tasted bad. Plants have become accustomed out of millennia of evolution with animals to producing chemicals so that they don't get cut down. And so some of these plants have a bad taste or chemicals in them that give them a tummy ache, And so plants have come a long way in their evolution as well. And so they taste a tree and they kind of go, oh, gee, that's not good. I got a bellyache out of that. I'm not gonna chew anymore on that. So they leave this cut in the tree, and then the tree says, oh, cool. and so the trees that have the bad taste are the ones that survive. And that may be true with Tree of Heaven. That may be why they don't cut as many of those as you'd like.
Well, and let's just talk a little bit about their whole life cycle. We talked about the fact that they'll live in these burrows along the river, mm-hmm. and how big they get. How long can they live?
10 to 15 years is an old beaver. That's quite an old one, actually, because they are traditionally preyed upon by lots of things, as many members of the rodent family are. They often don't live a great long lives by human standards, but 10 to 15 years is a pretty old beaver, that's for sure.
How many young would they typically have?
3 to 4 in a given year, and I think it depends very much on their nutrition. They'll have somewhat larger litters, maybe 5, a few more occasionally if they're in excellent shape. But if they've come through the winter in pretty rough condition, then their litter sizes are going to be small. And nutrition certainly impacts fecundity, ability to have young and support those young both in the womb and afterwards.
Now, of course, you know that I have experience as a wildlife rehabilitator,
right,
and I have rehabbed baby beavers, and it's incredibly difficult. And I just think about how high maintenance these little guys are for their mother and their father. And also, they have this sort of extended family structure, if they're fortunate,
yes,
where older siblings will also stick around and help out with the new young.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. They usually female, but not exclusively female, young of the previous year. I don't know that it goes beyond the previous year. It may, an aunt, if you will, that will help out sort of multi-generational families. They're very labor intensive, that's for sure. So.
They start out very small. Their little tails are about the size of a teaspoon. And then you talked about how big they get. Do they continue to grow throughout their entire lives?
Yeah, they do. And that's the amazing thing is that I'm not sure that anybody has done the experiments to know if growth actually stops or if it slows down. But you can tell, basically, large beavers tend to be older than the smaller ones. Males get larger than females, but still they appear to continue to grow. The teeth, and this is true of most rodents, the incisor teeth, those two incisors on the top and two in the bottom, those front teeth that we think about as beaver teeth, continue to grow, and they are self-sharpening. They are continuously growing, so they're, if you find a beaver skull, you can see a big C-shaped tooth that goes clear back into the skull, and it continues to grow the whole life, and they have an overbite. The front enamel on the tooth, that orange enamel, is harder, more difficult than the enamel that covers the back of the tooth. So when they bite down, the back of the tooth breaks off more easily than the front does. And so they're chisel-shaped and self-sharpening as they grow. So it's a pretty neat adaptation for being an animal that needs to have very sharp front incisors in order to cut down trees.
Well, and I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, we think about feathers as being the kind of thing that keeps you warm and dry if you're a wetland creature.
Right.
But beavers, of course, have fur. How do they keep themselves dry?
Oh, this is fascinating because it's true of all four of these species. A beaver, muskrat, otter, and mink all have sort of, I wouldn't call it waterproof fur, but they have an under fur that is very dense, can trap not only heat, but trap air as well to keep them warm under the water. And then they have oily guard feathers, it gives them the shininess looking, that are guard feathers. Did I say feathers? I did. Guard guard hairs that stick out and hold the fur out and keep them from getting soaked to the skin, as it were. So that covering is typical of aquatic mammals like this.
And that grooming process is incredibly important.
Right. It sure is. Constantly replenishing those oils and keeping the dirt off of there so that they can maintain that sort of waterproofing, as it were.
Right. Just one more job for the mama or daddy beaver.
Right.
The
exactly.
Human that's trying
exactly.
to fill in. Andy, do you ever see the beavers on the Iowa River?
No, they're busy late at night. So, yeah, I've not had the pleasure. I was doing a TV interview once, and the reporter got a rather large fright when a beaver came up and slapped his tail behind him. I thought he was going to fall in the river. That was pretty funny. That was live on air, too.
And how did you arrange to have him come up right at that
right.
moment?
Boy, if I could have. Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, great timing.
And So we don't see a lot of them because, of course, they're active at night. And I know, Andy, you've said you don't, if you know where they live, you don't want to tell people where they live because, of course, Iowa City is a town with a lot of people who could get very curious about them. But
Yes.
You're looking out for your employees.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Excellent. Jim, if you want to see them, how do you see them?
Well, the best way is to sit either on the shoreline where you know they are around or in a canoe or kayak, sit very quietly. They tend to be pretty nearsighted. Their senses of smell are quite keen. Their senses of hearing, despite very small ears, are quite good. And sense of taste is obviously good, but they tend to be pretty nearsighted. Both they and muskrats don't have terrific vision. In part, it's because they have this sort of extra nictitating membrane that goes over their eyes when they go under the water that protects the eyes. But they just aren't terribly, they can't see very far. So if you sit still, they notice motion. So if you sit still, very often you will give a chance to see them. I would say dawn and dusk are probably the best times, particularly in an urban area like Iowa City or any other city in the state. If you have them active at night, they can be active at all times of the day, particularly where humans are not. But when they feel the threat of humans, they become very nocturnal because that's when they're the least disturbed. So very early morning, right before daylight, and late in the evening at dusk. So dawn and dusk are probably the best times to
all
see
right.
them.
And I know a lot of homeowners get concerned when beavers move into the water near their homes. But Andy, it sounds like they can follow your lead and fence off the trees that they really care about, right?
Yep, that's right. You know, they need to eat too.
So. Yeah. Yeah, and what you talked about using chickenware is fine. I've recommended to people lots of times if they've got these rolls of old hog fencing around these farmsteads or sometimes in the local ditch, take that hog fencing, use the smaller mesh, put that down, and you can put it around the tree, and it's very heavy wire, so they won't bite through it and don't crawl through it. So it's a great way to protect them.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back. We'll talk more about some of the other hairy wetland creatures. Just like muskrats, otters, and mink when we get back. Andy Dahl, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Andy Dahl is the facilities management arborist at the University of Iowa, works alongside the Iowa River Beavers. And Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, is here today. He'll stick around. And you can, of course, join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about furry wetland creatures today. We've been talking mostly about beavers. We're also going to talk about muskrats, otters, maybe mink if we still have time. You are welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. And I think a lot of people get muskrats and beavers mixed up. I mean, especially if they're small ones. So
right, yeah.
Tell me how they differ.
Well, they differ in a number of ways. They're certainly related. They're both in the rodents. They both have incisors, those enlarged incisors in the front of their mouth, but they have strong chewing teeth in the back. The difference is size. Certainly a muskrat, maximum size for a muskrat, including the tail, is about, a foot and a half. Really big ones might reach 2 feet long. Beaver are much larger than that. The other difference is the tail. Beaver have a laterally flattened tail, so that's if you sat them on the table, the tail is flat across the table and is used actually as a prop when they're on ground. It helps keep them from falling over backwards when they're chewing on a tree. And whereas muskrats have a much smaller tail, both of them are mostly hairless, but the tail on the muskrat is vertically flattened. Not as much as you see on a beaver's tail, in other words, it's flat up and down, and they use that for propulsion underwater and for steering when they're on the surface. Both of them have webbed feet to help them swim. Beavers are more webbed than muskrats, but muskrats do have webbed feet as well. So it's a difference in size. What's interesting with all four of these critters, and we're talking beaver, muskrat, otter, and mink, they all have incredibly valuable furs. And it's the value of the fur that plus the loss of habitat that led them to either localized extinctions, meaning that in certain areas they disappeared, or it's also called extirpation. So they're certainly not found. And they were beaver were nearly extirpated from Iowa. Muskrat probably were very common, and certainly their numbers were greatly reduced, mostly due to habitat alteration, the draining of the palustrine wetlands. But the muskrat have come back and maintained. In fact, muskrat, in terms of the fur trade, is still the most, in total, the most valuable export of fur from Iowa to the fur market comes from muskrats.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're still trapped very, very heavily.
And so, you're far more likely to see a muskrat than a beaver.
Yeah. They're even more nearsighted. I remember lots of times as a kid in the backwaters of the Mississippi or the Iowa or the skunk or the Des Moines, the cedar, frequently just kind of gliding up to them. If we kept our paddles quiet, they wouldn't feel the vibrations in the water. We'd glide up to them in canoes, and they'd be within an arm's reach of the boat before they saw us and go, whoa, gee whiz, and then they'd dive under, you know. But so they're very nearsighted and very intent on their work, perhaps. So they were thinking about something else rather than the canoe coming towards them. So.
And what kinds of dwellings do they live in?
Yeah, they are primarily more herbaceous plant eaters. Unlike the beaver, which eats woody plants and takes the bark off those and the cambium layer off those twigs and buds and everything, muskrats tend to eat more herbaceous vegetation, things like cattails and tubers of underwater plants. Cattails in particular are used to construct their houses. And when we had so many of these palustrine wetlands, what you typically saw were lots of cattails and bulrushes and several other species of wetland plants, many of which are not very common anymore. Lots of people know about cattails, but not many people know about soft-stem bulrush or hard-stem bulrush and a variety of other things, all of which are eaten by muskrats. But their homes are often constructed of a combination of mud combined with cattails. And you would see across a marsh in the wintertime, you'd see these little bumps sticking up out of the marsh, and those are all muskrat houses. None of these critters are hibernators, so they have to maintain enough food to eat through the winter. In most cases, muskrats are active under the ice. They can hold their breath underwater for 10 minutes or more sometimes, easy to get out and swim underneath the ice and dig up some more tubers through the winter. And that digging activity and that eating of those plants is very, very important. A marsh, given no herbivory, no eating of the plants, will fill in very quickly with cattails and bulrushes, and so it'll be a solid mass. And in terms of many species, it's far too thick. Muskrats help thin that out. They keep the marsh, portions of the marshland open, and much better for things like mallards and pintails and blue-winged teal and other lots of rails and other things. They don't like it totally closed in. They like sort of a hemi-marsh. Some of about half of it is emergent vegetation and half is not.
So they're making it nice for other species.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Now, we've talked a little bit about how Iowa wetlands changed. I mean, one of the big changes in recent years was the outlawing of the use of lead shot in wetland areas.
Right. Yeah.
And I know that there were some wetlands that just couldn't sustain life because they were so poisoned.
Right.
Have we seen a significant increase in water quality and life in wetlands since that?
Well, I'd say yes, but it's more the fact that we're just putting some water back on the land. Programs like the Wetland Reserve Program, the Private Lands Program of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service helped put lots of wetlands back on. There were some private wetland reconstruction programs that were going on. And landowners have done that primarily out of an altruism. I've talked to research I did with landowners who restored their wetlands particularly in the 90s, showed, and this is across the country, not just in Iowa, but across 18 states. I interviewed people, and they were doing it for reasons. They said, I want to do it for natural beauty. I want to do it for the wildlife. I want to leave something wild for future generations. It's amazing. That was very altruistic reasons. reasons for bringing them back. I had lots of stories from these landowners that said, well, I'm sure my father's turning over in his grave now because he worked to drain this and I'm putting it back,
right.
You know. So, but they're putting it back because they realized how many species of wildlife depend on that. And so these programs, and landowners have responded very, very well to them, have really put a lot of wetlands back on the land. So that has helped as much as anything. Whether the reduction in lead in particular has led to healthier critters, certainly it has in birds. I don't know how it's impacted mammals. They tended to be, I don't know that we have the data on the mammals to say either way whether it's impacted them or not, but certainly it's made for these reconstructed wetlands to be much healthier for birds that are using them.
Well, and we're not talking about fish today, but Dan and Ames would like to talk a little bit about fish and water quality. Hi, Dan. Dan, are you there? All right.
Not getting one.
No, he's been very patient on the line, but apparently has wandered away from the phone. Dan, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, what would you like to talk about?
Fish. I don't know if that's associated with the furry creatures. I used to sample the creeks when I was going to college here in aquatic ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wanted to talk about the degradation of the need to put in more buffer strips, mainly.
Right, yeah. And certainly beaver in particular, by producing wetlands, those wetlands become a buffer both against flooding and against sedimentation of the stream, because the wetlands slow the water down. Water that comes in off the surface then gets filtered out, and they provide a buffer for particularly the farther up towards the headwaters it is. And you're right, buffers along our streams would certainly help prevent both nutrients coming in off of agricultural fields as well as soil coming into those streams as well. So, yeah, I would agree. And certainly the USDA knows that, and they've had for over 10 years now, they've had probably 15 years now, I've had a buffer program, and it a number of people have enrolled, but certainly we've got lots of streams and rivers that are not buffered sufficiently at all, that's for sure.
Right, and we've seen more people farming right along streams and rivers in the last few years because of the inflated corn prices as well. So it's make some progress and take a couple steps back at the same time.
Honestly, I've seen it depends on the watershed. In all the rivers I paddled, some were horrible that way, and others were... The landowners in that area and that watershed seem to be much more respectful of that. So it varies a lot across the state.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for your call. Mm-hmm. Wally is on the line in Bradford. Hi, Wally.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Got a question for Jim. Years and years ago, the muskrat was the backbone of every trapper's business.
Right.
And I only learned recently that in the last 20 years, muskrats throughout the Midwest declined precipitously. What is the situation, and did they ever figure out what caused that? I heard it variably attributed to ag chemicals. They said from Illinois to South Dakota, they disappeared.
Yeah, I disappeared is not. It's still the most valuable fur in total in terms of the quantity that is comes from the state. You add up, you know, you get one mink, but you might get 50 muskrats, kind of thing. You're right. The numbers are way down from what they used to be. I don't know of any research right off the top of my head. I'm trying to think of what caused the decline, whether it was disease or simple habitat loss or the impact, the long-term impact of drought. I don't know that anybody knows for certain what it was, but they, as you know, they can, within a given area, the muskrat populations tend to be cyclic. They tend to go up and down just as the vegetation does and as the weather changes from year to year. And Paul Arrington here at Iowa State discovered that in in the 1950s and 60s, his research showed that they were very cyclical, and that varied with the marsh that they were part of. That was a typical sort of thing with muskrats. But the widespread loss of numbers across the Midwest, I don't know that anybody figured out exactly what the reason was, but they seem to be bouncing back, at least in some areas.
All right, Wally, thank you so much for your call. Bruce is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I had a question about a beaver. Well, a long time ago, right in the middle of Des Moines, I took my daughter down to look at a beaver dam. I think she was studying in school or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the beaver cut down an 18 to 24-inch diameter cottonwood.
Sure.
I've always kind of wondered why they would cut down such a big tree.
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, the big logs, they couldn't move, obviously, but they could move the smaller branches. The branches that are arm size are often cut into chunks that are about a foot long, and those are called chocks, C-H-O-C-K-S, and those are actually used as sort of support members of the in dam construction. Anything smaller than that, mostly finger size or smaller, are used for food. And it's the buds. So in order to get at a great big cottonwood like that, to get at that small food-producing branches, you have to cut the tree down to get to it. And so that's what they were doing. They were cutting it down and having all of those leaves and small branches in the upper portion that were available to them. And if they were doing dam building, they would cut the arm-size branches into chocks for their dam.
Right, and if you're going to build a dam, you need some big branches.
Right, right.
You can't
exactly.
do it all with tiny little
right.
trees, right?
That's right.
That's just
right.
an incredible amount of work. Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, and so I don't think we're going to get to both otters and mink.
But
river otters, we've talked a little bit about them on shows in the past. They are a species that has made a tremendous comeback in Iowa.
Yeah, and the comeback for all of these critters has been due to active management by people who care about them, and that includes trappers. The Iowa Trappers Association has been very, very involved in bringing back critters that previous trappers had trapped out, and so they are very strong in the conservation movement, and they helped bring back the otters to Iowa. It was a three-way trade. We shipped otters we shipped turkeys to, I don't remember now if it was New York or Michigan or something, and they then paid Louisiana that trapped otters, live trapped otters, and shipped them to Iowa. So it was a three-way trade among states. It was quite fascinating, and they the release back in the state has been phenomenally successful. They're now all over the state, in every county in the state. But they're very tough to see, both mink and otter, as well as beaver and muskrat. It's not like you can get out on a river or a stream and be guaranteed of seeing them, because they're quite secretive. Otters, being large, are maybe a little easier to see than mink, but they're always present. And mink are actually, in most of our major cities, people might be surprised to know that we have mink running around, because they're very adaptable. They're aquatic, and yet they will also come up on land hunting mice and other rodents in prairies and other areas that you didn't expect them to be. I have actually found a dead one right in the middle of the Iowa State University campus, a long ways from water. It got hit by a car, some years ago. So it was they're very, very adaptable little guys. Otter are less so. They are especially fond of a fish diet, and whether that portends, particularly they like rough fish, things like big carp and that sort of thing. Doesn't mean they won't take other species. They certainly will, but they're very rough. They love rough fish, and if they eat those rough fish, that helps us, I think, getting those invasive carp out of the rivers. So
makes me want to go on a canoe trip.
You
Jim,
bet, absolutely.
We really
get out there.
Should if we possibly can, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right. Jim Peace, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Wildlife wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He joins us once a month to talk about Iowa's wild creatures and wild places. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.